You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Martin Indyk, the Director of the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. And we're delighted today to have the honor to host Vali Nasser and his book launch for The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. Vali Nasser has written a scorcher of a book with amazing and fascinating insights into the workings of the Obama administration when it came to perhaps the most important foreign policy issue of the first term of the Obama administration, that is what is referred to in bureaucraties as the AFPAC issue of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Vali Nasser had an inside view of policymaking on that issue and the broader issues of foreign policy towards South Asia and the greater Middle East. As the senior advisor to U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, the late Ambassador Richard Holbrooke. He held that position from early on in the administration in 2009 through 2011, leaving there soon after Richard Holbrooke's sad passing. And that is at the core of this book that he's going to speak to us about today. But this book goes beyond that. It is a critique of broader foreign policy approach of President Obama. And it has some important things to say about the United States' involvement in the greater Middle East. So I'm very happy to have the opportunity to host this conversation with Vali Nasser today. He is currently the Dean of the Johns Hopkins University Paul H. Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies, just across the way there, a contributor to Bloomberg View. He wrote this book while he was, or a good part of this book, while he was a senior fellow here in the foreign policy program at Brookings after he left government. Now that he is the dean of Johns Hopkins SAIS, we're proud to have him as a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings. He is the author of a number of other important books, particularly the bestseller, The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. That was written and published in 2006, but has profound implications for what has since occurred in terms of schism between Sunnis and Shias. Join me in conducting the conversation and responding to Vali's presentation, I'm very happy to have my colleague Bob Kagan with us today. He is a senior fellow in the Center for the U.S. and Europe at Brookings. He is a member of the Secretary of State's Foreign Affairs Policy Board and co-chairman of the Bipartisan Working Group on Egypt. He served in the State Department from 1984 to 1988 as a member of the policy planning staff and worked directly for George Shultz when he was Secretary of State, also as Deputy for Policy in the Bureau of Inter-American Affairs. Bob is probably known to you all for his profound work on American foreign policy, The Dispensable Nation, American foreign, that's not your profound word, Dangerous Nation. He wrote Dispensable Nation. You wrote Dangerous Nation. Between the two of you, we may as well just pack up and go home. You wrote Dangerous Nation. about American foreign policy. It's the first of a two-volume work, and we're looking forward to the second volume of this comprehensive assessment of American foreign policy. He also is the author of The World America Made, a shorter volume but no less impactful, that became a New York Times bestseller a couple of years ago. So, without further ado, Valley, the podium is yours. Welcome and congratulations for a great book.
Thank you, Martin, for that introduction. And it's good to be here with Bob. It's good to be here back at Brookings. And good morning. I thought about writing this book after I came out of government and reflected on what were some of the lessons I saw up front about our decision-making in foreign policy, and what it might say about where we're heading and what is the perception of our foreign policy internationally. And I reflected back, actually, I thought of some of the early vignettes that I gathered when we were talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan. And very early on, it was in September of 2009, when the administration was beginning its strategic review for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And at that point, Afghanistan and Pakistan was a very frontal, important issue for the administration. The president had, during the campaign, looked at Afghanistan as the right war, as the war of necessity, and a war that we would end in the proper way, protecting American security and bringing some kind of stability and order to Afghanistan. So how we would do that was a big topic. And at the Office of Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, SRAP, where Ambassador Holbrooke was appointed, if you would, as the AFPAC czar, we actually took that fairly seriously, that this was a real effort to come up with a new strategy for ending the war. It was quite evident that even before we got into the strategic review, that we were going to go down the path of putting many more troops on the ground and pursue the idea that we would defeat the Taliban, that the path out of Afghanistan would be a military victory over the Taliban and reversing their trend. So in September 2009, during the United Nations General Assembly meeting in New York, Holbrooke's mandate was basically to shop around this idea with friends, allies, regional powers, to go to meeting after meeting and tell them that, A, we were committed to Afghanistan in the long run. We were committed to South Asia and the Middle East. We would see the war to its end. And we had a plan, and the plan was to defeat the Taliban and stand up a democratic, viable state and economy in Afghanistan. And really the subtext was, we know what we do and trust in our strategy. And I remember going with them from meeting to meeting, and what we got was not sort of sense of great. At last there's an American strategy, there's a path forward, but rather incredulous disbelief. Nobody was really buying this storyline. Nobody believed we had the commitment, and nobody believed the strategy would work. And I remember one Arab foreign minister sort of lost his patience with the message and said to Holbrooke, in a very actually friendly tone, that, look, this won't work. Why don't you just pay the warlords to take care of al-Qaeda and then go home? I said, I figure it's going to cost you $20 billion, which is a lot cheaper than what you're advocating. And those people know how to take care of this problem. And if you try to do what you're saying you're going to do, you're going to fail. And when you fail, it's bad for you and it's bad for us. And, that was not what Holbrooke was, hoping to hear. And he tried his best effort to push back. But then we went to another meeting with another Arab foreign minister who basically said the same thing, that, why don't you just pay the local, power brokers and warlords to take care of the security problem? They know how to do it. And stop this idea of surging in Afghanistan and just go home. Except he had a much lower price tag that it would cost you $1 billion, and he added a proviso that actually the Taliban should be your friend because they also are opposed to Iran, and you should be focusing on Iran, not on the Taliban, and you can work with them. And this whole strategy doesn't make sense. It was very clear early on that, you know, this idea that we would import the Iraq war into Afghanistan really had no buyers in the region, not just because people had not seen a victory in Iraq, but nobody thought that it would work. It seemed like we were the only ones that thought this was a good idea. What we heard plenty was an argument that instead of surging, you should actually look seriously at diplomacy. Whether it was Saudis, Qataris, UAE, Karzai himself, Pakistanis, Norwegians, Germans, British, you could look at any country you spoke to would tell you that there is a path to diplomacy and you should explore it, that this war cannot end on the battlefield with an American surge, but that you have to find a political settlement. And plenty of them, from Europeans to Middle Eastern government, said that they've had enough contacts with the Taliban that they think there is something here to be explored. And there were people on Richard Holbrooke's team, particularly my colleague Barnett Rubin, who basically followed a lot of these leads, and ultimately a lot of his ideas were embraced as part of the reconciliation conversation. Holbrooke himself thought that the surge was a bad idea, that if you really surged and if you really were committed to the surge, you'll end up in a Vietnam scenario. It's not going to work, and you have to keep doubling down. And it was much better to use the potentiality of American intervention to get Pakistan and the Taliban to negotiate. And then when we did put troops on the ground, he thought that we ought to use the leverage of American military presence on the ground and a desire by both Pakistan and Afghanistan for us to leave as leverage to get to negotiations. And he often said that, the more troops you put on the ground, the sooner you will withdraw. And the more you tell everybody in the region that you're going to put a lot of troops in, the more they're convinced you're not going to stay because they know you don't have the stamina. If you put a lot fewer troops on the ground with a lot less of an ambition of saying your troops are there just to protect Kabul, it's much more likely that they would take it seriously, that you have a long-run strategy. And he also argued very vociferously for a diplomatic strategy, that the military option in Afghanistan should be in support of diplomacy, not the other way around. We shouldn't use diplomacy to facilitate war and support the war. But I think the critical issue was that Holbrooke never got to put this option before the strategic review. So if you look at the president's strategic review as it's described in Bob Woodward's book, there were only two options on the table: an option of a fully resourced counterinsurgency, which is essentially the Iraq model, which was championed by the military, and a very lightfoot counterterrorism strategy, which the vice president favored. And at that point in time, nobody thought it was viable and was really used as a straw man, not taken seriously. So essentially, there was only one strategy on the table. And the diplomatic strategy, many may argue, may have not worked, may have failed, but the critical issue was that it was never discussed. It was never really looked at. And as hard as Holbrooke pushed, it was never put on the table. Now, you might say that this was all the overhang of Iraq, even though President Obama promised a new policy in the region, promised to break with what came out of the Iraq war. At some level, he could not really overcome the popularity of the military coming out of Iraq, having essentially saved the day in Iraq, and very quickly succumbed to embracing the counterinsurgency strategy for Afghanistan, even though he clearly really didn't believe in it. And then the first opportunity he took was to put limit on it, which is he approved the surge, but with a timetable. And then he very quickly announced that we think we're won and we're leaving. Again, I remember going to many leaders in the region along with Holbrook and at times with Secretary Clinton, and the attitude very clearly was that we knew you're not going to stick with this strategy. We knew it wasn't going to work, and we told you so. And we're not buying the narrative that you're selling now, which is that we're going to build an Afghan military. Initially was supposed to be 400,000. Now the number has been reduced to half. That's going to be doing what you couldn't do or wouldn't do. If this was a good idea, why didn't you do it in the first place instead of surging? And secondly, we just don't think it's going to work. I remember one Pakistani general said that, you know, all you're going to be doing is to be training Afghans to shoot better. And as soon as you leave, this military is going to collapse into varieties of militias, and it's going to be a big headache for us. If you want to leave, leave. Just don't make any more trouble on your way out. I think the outcome in Afghanistan, largely because it was driven by our domestic consideration, it was driven by a particular form of decision-making that I think was designed to lead to a particular outcome for the president, which had domestic value. A young Democratic president might be seen as weak if he disagreed with the military on the surge. And then, you know, it played to the domestic public opinion, which was tired of the Afghanistan war. But the way that we conducted this war essentially was that there is no victory and there is no political settlement. And its ramifications for what it means in terms of credibility of American foreign policy in the region and beyond is quite negative. And I think that is then amplified by a broader attitude, which is also comes out of the out of Iraq in a different way, which is to downgrade the Middle East is important to global politics and to American foreign policy. So if there is one fundamental assumption beyond the early effort to address Afghanistan, and then basically the conclusion of Afghanistan was that we're just going to leave and we really don't need to have a satisfactory conclusion or a long-run vision for Afghanistan, is that more broadly, we really don't need to worry about the Middle East either. So just as we really don't need to worry about Afghanistan, we really don't need to worry about the Middle East. You know, this is couched in the pivot to Asia language, but it's become the bedrock of our approach to the region, that whether it is in Arab Spring, whether it's a historical transformation in the Middle East, whether it's a civil war in Syria, that more broadly the United States can afford not to be engaged with this region. And doing less is better. Doing less is more. And I think that does pose certain dangers and risks for American foreign policy. If we looked at the case of the Arab Spring, if you take the case of Egypt, the most important Arab country, the one that we all know that will be deciding in many ways the direction of events in the region. And if you looked at the level of American engagement in a process of historic process of democratization in that country and compared it with the way in which the United States engaged in democratization efforts in Latin America, Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe, it's the contrast is very clear. We're not engaged politically. We're not engaged, most importantly, economically. The United States has not been engaged with IMF efforts in Egypt. It has not been engaged in transforming that country's economy. It's by and large has been a reactive policy, which does not see a major stake for the United States in Egypt. In the first decade after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the United States led the IMF and the international community to invest over $100 billion in Eastern European economies. We invested over $40 billion in Mexico's transition. We invested huge amounts of money in Russia, in Southeast Asia, in the rest of Latin America. Economic transformation early on was the critical first step in anchoring democratization in the right direction. If you looked at the amount of commitment from the United States in particular to economic transformation in the Arab Spring, it's paltry. At the Deauville meeting of industrialized countries, there was a commitment of $9 billion for the all of Arab world, of which only about $116 million has been put into the fund. People may argue in many ways why the Arab Spring will fail. There's too much Islam. There's too much conflict. There's no partners to work with. There are constitutional crises, all of which may be true. But there's one also big significant differentiator between this democratization and other democratizations, and that is fundamentally the level of our commitment and leadership, and particularly level of economic investment in making sure democratization stays on track. And that really speaks to not just that Europe or the United States have economic problems at home, but also more broadly to the assumption that the Middle East doesn't matter and it should be downgraded in terms of our global politics. And I think that is very well reflected also in our approach to Syria, which is, is premised on, as the President told the New Republic, on the idea that there's no difference between Syria and the Congo. It's as important or unimportant, depending on what your view is. And that is a very big assumption. So we get lost in sort of the debates about, can we do X in Syria or can we do Y or whether this works or whether that works. But the far bigger issue really for American foreign policy is the assumption that Syria and the Middle East don't matter to American foreign policy, don't matter to global order, that we really can afford a hands-off approach with this region and we can basically ignore it. Anyways, why don't I stop here and be very happy to
continue. Interesting, powerful, and controversial thesis. And I want to invite Bob to make a few comments and then we can get into a conversation.
Well, I mean, the book is terrific, first of all, and I strongly recommend it, having read it and enjoyed it. And it's a very sweeping view. Vali only had a few minutes to talk about the subjects that he highlighted, which is Afghanistan and to some extent on the Middle East in general. But there's discussion of Iran, there's discussion of China and its role in the Middle East, potential role in the Middle East. So I recommend, and Vali has interesting and intelligent things to say about all of them. You know, I don't far be it from me to try to defend the Obama administration, but, the missing part of your story so far is what, the situation that Obama inherited, and both a real unhappiness with the policies that had been conducted by the previous administration, rightly or wrongly, in both Iraq and Afghanistan, a kind of weariness, but then compounded and recompounded, of course, by a terrible, the worst economic recession since the Great Depression, which, if you look at American history, American interventionism, American involvement, American interest in the world is heavily influenced by those kinds of situations. So you have a post-Vietnam period, which was also accompanied by economic strife, and you get the foreign policy of the Carter administration. And in general, if you look at American foreign policy in terms of general intervention, it's kind of like a sine wave. We go through periods of high intervention. We're usually disillusioned and unhappy with we start off with great expectations about what we're going to accomplish, and then somehow we don't always meet those expectations, and we sort of lose steam. For me, it's hard to imagine a president elected in 2008, let alone a president from the opposition party, who wasn't going to, in some way, try to dial back the involvement for both economic and political reasons. The question is, not was that inevitable. I think that was inevitable, whether things could be done intelligently or not intelligently. And again, through my long history, my long study of American history, the odds of us doing it intelligently are low. We mostly... I hate to break it to everybody, but we're not really geniuses at conducting foreign policy. We're very successful because we're very rich, we're very powerful. We have, a very good set of moral codes, which are generally quite attractive. But genius in the conduct of foreign policy is not really our thing. Now, that's true of most countries, by the way. Nobody conducts intelligent foreign policy, in my view. So that's just kind of a background. How much do we have to sort of say this is a uniquely bad conduct of foreign policy, or this is kind of a predictable trend, which was done in a predictable fashion? And when I look at the Arab Spring, I actually don't think it's been the administration's view on Egypt, for instance, which is something that I've followed closely, that Egypt is not important. I think their view is that it's very important. When you talk about the resources that we've put into it economically, well, I think obviously there is a constraint on the amount of resources that we could. This is not 1947, 48, when we have, tens of billions of dollars to pour into Europe. This is a time of economic constraint. But that notwithstanding, I think they do think Egypt's important, and they really haven't quite known what to do with it. Now, in my view, they've handled it wrong, and I can critique it. But I think it's also fair to say it hasn't been an easy situation. And this sort of gets to some of your broader and deeper questions about the Middle East and about what's going on in Islam. I think that the Middle East poses a uniquely difficult kind of problem for the United States. I think that the clash of, I won't call it civilizations, but certainly there is more going on here than sort of basic, strategic and economic issues. And it's been very hard for the United States to know exactly. Once we moved away from just supporting whatever strongman had to be supported at any given moment, once we started dealing with a popular movement in a part of the world where we never dealt with popular movements, I think we are still finding our way. And it's not easy. It's not easy on their end, where anything we try to do, it comes as a double-edged sword to them. And it's not easy on our end, where we harbor all kinds of resentments and complications in our dealings. So my general view is that we have to be a little sympathetic to the difficulties that any administration faces. And both in Afghanistan and in dealing with the Arab Spring, I think these were really hard problems for the administration to try to address. And that's my basic comment.
Want to respond?
No, it's very good points. First of all, my aim was not to sort of compare necessarily to other administrations or the past, although that's always inevitable, but rather to essentially point out where do we stand right now and what are the dangers of where we stand. I fully agree with what the administration inherited. But unfortunately, you don't have the luxury of saying you can hit a pause button on foreign policy because we have domestic issues or because there is a fatigue. In fact, I think it's required of the presidency or American leadership to actually push back against domestic sentiments, and it's up to them to really argue why particular activities matter. For instance, if you took Syria today, maybe most Americans don't realize why should Syria matter to us, why it's not Congo. If you thought it was Congo, then we've been down that path before. Is it Rwanda or is it Bosnia? The administration articulated an argument why Bosnia matters to the United States and why Rwanda doesn't. I would say, with Afghanistan, the peculiar thing is that the president actually didn't push back. He didn't dial the back. He actually surged at a tremendous cost, which I think then made the foreign policy discussion more difficult. In fact, the diplomats' argument was go for a more sustainable strategy that wouldn't be so costly, and you actually could stay the course. And so we vacillated between two domestic tendencies. One was the sort of pro-surge, pro-military tendency, and then veered towards the war fatigue tendency immediately after that.
You don't think, can I just ask, you don't think we surged in order to leave? I mean, you know, in Vietnam, I think Nixon, it took longer, it was drawn out more, and it was also the war against communism, so it was a bigger deal for him to pull out. But he surged in order to leave, ultimately.
Yes, he surged in order to leave, but even then, his generals were telling him that a surge is a 15-year deal.
Yeah.
So if you're biting into this strategy, you have to be committed long run. I think, you know, the very first people who were quite shocked by his deadline were the very architects of fully resourced counterinsurgency. And, you know, as you know, they kept kicking and screaming to have a more slow and shallow withdrawal rather than a steep and deep withdrawal. So yeah, I think it would have been better for us not to have overcommitted in Afghanistan and had maintained many more options. And in reality, when it comes to the Arab Spring, I mean, 3 months, 2 months of the cost of war in Afghanistan would be transformative in Egypt. It's not that we were always bankrupt. It's where we spend our money. I actually completely agree with you that the Middle East is extremely difficult and complicated. But I think not being engaged with it, it doesn't make that complication go away. And we cannot fix many things in the Middle East. We cannot fix the constitutional struggle. But economic issues were among the things that we could have had even a remote influence on. You know, between 2011 and today, there are 1 million more Egyptians that are unemployed. And that's the most probably significant statistic about that country and the direction it's going. Now, you know, with IMF engagements and the package that is on the table, it's always a matter of global engagement. So, you know, the United States has not always put all the money on the table. It has played the role of a convening power. You know, the IMF went to Egypt 2 weeks ago for a negotiations over a $5.8 billion deal. Before the IMF could conclude the deal, Qatar and Libya gave Egypt $5 billion, which pretty much killed the IMF deal for now, and economic reform. So the question people ask is, where was the United States in this? It's not a matter of its own money. Did anybody call Qatar and Libya and say, that, you know, you should coordinate with the IMF or that, you know, or put together a bigger package around the world that would provide Egypt with a greater incentive on top of the IMF package. And then, you know, beyond just sort of the symbolism, when you go to the Middle East, the message they're getting, even from American officials that visit, is that we're washing our hands off this region. We're leaving. I mean, the meaning of the word pivot to Asia essentially is understood that we're pivoting away from the Middle East. It's a sort of a binary choice. Now, you know, I think the point you raise is very, very important, that if a problem around the world is very complicated, should we actually just try not to deal with it at all, and whether we can afford not to deal with it at all and let it be because it's too complicated, or we have to remain engaged and try to probe in any which way we can. And I take your point. It may not be a very straightforward answer, but my purpose is really for us to really debate this rather than sleepwalk into a narrative that is largely internal to this city and is internal to us and is not really credible or accepted outside and does run certain risks. There is risk to actions, but there's also a great risk to inaction, which we really have to consider.
Let's focus in. We'll come back to the great game in the Middle East in a moment, but I want to focus in a little on, because you had a ringside seat in the policy debate. And essentially, what you were arguing and what Richard Holbrooke was arguing was you needed to use force, but to use force to back your diplomacy. And you said basically that option was never really considered. And that kind of rang a bell with me, because I can remember making the same argument
in the Clinton administration when we were trying to deal with Saddam Hussein and trying to put forward a strategy of diplomacy backed by the threat or use of force. And it was totally rejected at that time because of kind of Vietnam syndrome. We tried that in Vietnam. We tried to bomb them to the negotiating table. You know, it didn't work, and therefore we're not going to go that way. It was kind of purposeful abandonment of what appeared from a diplomat's point of view a logical and rational strategy. To what extent, Valley, did you see that playing out? That is to say, just an unwillingness to consider the notion that you could use force to back your diplomacy. We know the military don't like to be used in that way. But what did you see in terms of the White House's attitude towards that argument?
Well, you're correct. I mean, Holbrooke's point of reference was really the Balkans, where he thought that the military basically were his wingmen, were there to get Milosevic's attention and make him realize he can win and he needs to negotiate. And that's the way he thought Afghanistan ought to be played, largely because literally everybody said there is a diplomatic path other than the United States. So he didn't even think that we really needed to work hard to get everybody else sold on diplomacy, the Saudis, Pakistanis, Karzai himself. They may have different tactical approaches, but they all believed that this ought to be done, and there was a great deal of support for that. What he found was that there was no... Obviously, the military was not interested in this because they didn't think that negotiations had anything to do with the end of the Iraq War. I think General Petraeus told Mark Lander at one time that this is not the Balkans. It didn't finish that way. So their conception was counterinsurgency goes on for as long as it goes, and you only negotiate with foot soldiers who come in. So they didn't like the word reconciliation. They liked the word reintegration, which was basically attrition of the enemy. And they thought that talk of diplomacy would be construed as weakness. I think in the White House there was two approaches. One was that they also thought that the spectacle of talking to the Taliban would be construed as weakness, domestically speaking. And secondly, I don't think those who at the helm really had experience with diplomacy. And you had a generation of younger people who were, you know, post-Vietnam and even post-Balkans. They had not any foreign policy experience. Many of them came out of the domestic scene and the campaign world. For them, the resonance of what foreign policy approaches would mean in terms of headlines at times mattered more than what it means on the ground. And you know, often they treated Holbrooke as a dinosaur, you know, whose time was past, and they didn't see great value for it. So the argument often went that, you know, the case hasn't been made. There's no evidence that the Taliban want to talk. That this is a ruse, and therefore, you know, we ought to fight another season and then think about it. And then largely there was a way in which to keep this conversation out of where it had to be considered at the highest level. So it never appeared at that critical moment, even if the president had looked at it as an option and then rejected it. But it never even appeared as an option to consider. So I think Afghanistan in many ways was a big defeat for American diplomacy. And the conception that emerged in Afghanistan was that the job of the diplomats is to do the civilian part of the work and then go around the world and get support for the military. So, you know, a lot has been made about the fact that the State Department didn't do a good job running the civilian surge, as they called it, you know, growing pomegranates and sending agricultural laborer and running AID. But the reality is that that's not what they really should have been doing. They were put in that position that you're the civilian partners of the military. So they occupy territory. You're supposed to build up government, rule of law, grow the pomegranate. We used to joke in SRAP that Holbrooke had become the chief agricultural officer for for Afghanistan. And then the other idea was that, which actually this Holbrooke really cultivated and they accepted it, at least let us go around the world and sell the war. So you know, he created this SRAP collective, which by the time he passed away, I think had 33 members. And so they would meet every 6 months to coordinate their individual governments' contribution to the war. So diplomacy basically was there to help the war. And I think that he was never able to change that. And I think Secretary Clinton was sold on the fact that the State Department had to play a leading role. And I think that was ultimately blocked as well.
Well, that's the head-scratcher in this account, Val, is that here you have Hillary Clinton and Richard Holbrooke, both very powerful personalities, unable to basically get the White House to give a serious airing to the approach that they wanted to pursue.
Well, she also lost, by the way, she and Gates both lost the battle against setting the deadline.
Right.
So it wasn't only in one direction that they couldn't persuade the White House. I mean, you have your Secretary of State and your Secretary of Defense both recommending the same thing. That's usually a go at that
against
point.
Against setting the deadline that the president did when he announced the surge.
And she and Petraeus and Dempsey and Panetta collectively failed to change their approach on Syria. I mean, you know, the president is the chief foreign policy decision maker.
He got elected.
He got elected, and the foreign policy team at the White House is there to essentially protect him from certain decisions or forward certain decisions. And in that sense, I mean, Holbrooke always used to say that this is a different NSC from the ones I've worked on. Its job is taking its job from filtering and providing the president with options a level further to actually making policy and then looking at the various institutions of government as basically having the role of implementer of the policy. I mean, the reason Holbrooke had so much difficulty because he hadn't read the memo, refused to read the memo. He constantly tried to make policy rather than implement it. As to Secretary Clinton, I think, you know, she pushed very hard for making the voice of the State Department at the NSC heard very well. I mean, there were times that even though she literally was the only civilian, in a sense, in an NSC that is over-dominated by the military and intelligence, and she was the only woman, she was extremely tough in putting the position of the State Department forward. But there are some structural elements there that is not about personalities and how powerful they are. This is the way the system works. So she was extremely effective within the system, but she's not in a position to create the system or change the system.
One other question about this that ties in with what you're saying is that the president on his second day in office appointed Richard Holbrooke and George Mitchell at the same time as his special envoys, one for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and one for the Israeli-Palestinian peace effort that he wanted to make a priority. And yet, one gets the sense that in both cases, he didn't use them. And so just in the case of Holbrooke, why was that? He was his special envoy. He didn't take him on trips, as you explain in the book. He didn't signal that Holbrooke was his man and in that way empower him.
How much of this was personality?
Was it a personality?
Well, if it was personality, he should have never appointed him. If he didn't want him, he should have fired him. I think, and you know, a lot of people who reviewed my book or others have said, it was Holbrooke's own fight because he wouldn't get along with the ambassador or he had a fight with Karzai. But Petraeus had a fight with Karzai. Biden walked out of a dinner with Karzai. But Karzai wouldn't dare pick a fight with him because there was no indication given that either Petraeus or Biden are fair game. Whereas every indication was given to Karzai that Holbrooke's boss doesn't have his back. And in fact, there were many times that Karzai's theatrics was used as a way of trying to fire Holbrooke. you know, it's a bizarre, I think, to me, it's a bizarre approach, largely whether it's personalities or not, because it really undermines your policy. With Pakistanis, with both Pakistanis and Afghans, the signal very early on was given that basically you can go around Holbrooke, either directly to the military or directly to the White House. The Pakistani reaction and the Afghan reaction was quite different. Karzai really held Holbrooke responsible for taking the election seriously, for actually pushing him on varieties of things. And often he used beating on Holbrooke because he couldn't beat on anybody else. It was his way of signaling his displeasure with the administration. The Pakistanis, on the other hand, actually understood that Holbrooke had limited access to the policymaking, but they also understood that he actually was a rainmaker. He did deliver on many things. So when there was a flood that covered 30% of Pakistan, if it wasn't for Holbrooke, the amount of U.S. aid that went there would not have happened. They knew that, you know, he got on the phone personally with Admiral Mullen to get more helicopters to be taken from Waziristan to the flood areas, or with internally displaced persons over SWAT, or varieties of things that when he made a promise, he actually really did push and advocate and get things done. So, but they also understood that there is this game going in Washington that the president's special envoy does not have his backing, does not have access to him, does not meet with the president. So if Karzai is in a meeting in Lisbon with the president or in the White House, often Ambassador Eikenberry would be there, but not Holbrooke. So, you know, we sort of took our dirty laundry of whatever it is, which was the reason, and displayed it in the middle of the most important foreign policy issue without any care as to what would it do to our policy. And yes, I'm sure it was personality, but also it was also personality wars at various levels. I think there were people who held a grudge for Holbrooke's overzealous support of Secretary Clinton during
the campaign. He only knew one kind of support.
He knew only one kind of support, exactly. There were those who I think there were petty jealousies or angers from other periods. They thought that if you let Holbrooke put his toe in, he's going to put his foot in, and then he's going to get in, and you got to slam the door the minute you see him. Regardless. So the answer to everything he said was basically no. And when they were convinced, they took it away from him and they said, thank you very much. Now we'll take it on. I think at one point, you know, he was told at the end that, you know, even if we do reconciliation, it won't be you who will be the chief negotiator, anybody but you, almost. And I think thirdly, there was a sense among the way the president was elected in a massive sweeping victory by many young people, there was a general sort of disrespect for experience and history early on, that people would roll their eyes by people who might make a reference to Clark Clifford or who is he, you know, or Vietnam, and that they know better, that there was this attitude that they know a lot better, and either these people play by their rules or they don't play at all.
Bob, you want to comment on this?
Well, I mean, you know, it's the terrible thing about being a historian when you're trying to figure these things out is that, you know, on the one hand, you want to talk about the big sweeping forces that get everything done, and then you get down to this, like, you know, Holbrooke was annoying the president, and that's why we got the policy we got. And
it's the way he ate chips, I gather.
Right. Well, I don't know. Yeah. But I just go back to the whole reconciliation with the Taliban question, because I still feel like you were in the middle of it, but looking at it from the outside, I would say, why is this not a reasonable argument to have held? Namely, that until the Taliban decide that we are serious about defeating them if necessary, they have no incentive to cut any deal we could possibly live with. And that even if you felt that you wanted a deal, you would have to spend some time schmicing them, I think is the term of art that I'm looking for, that you'd have to be really hammering them to convince them to come to the table. And I think since you are probably not mistaken in thinking that probably nothing we could have done would have convinced them that we were going to stay in Afghanistan long enough and that if they didn't wait us out, they could get whatever they wanted. But even if that's true, under those circumstances, how do you convince them to make a reasonable deal? I guess I'd love to hear your answer to that.
Actually, it's a very good point. And actually, that's the kind of a discussion that we should have had at the highest levels around the Situation Room. But I would say, first of all, you had to beat him. The military part had to support diplomacy. But you had to come up with how are you going to beat them in a sustained way that is credible to them, and you can do it. So maybe fully resourced coin with a 15-year, success, window was not the really best way of beating them. So it might have required a different kind of military strategy, might have required maybe holding large parts of the country and then, basically telling them you're not going anywhere. But the other piece of this, the way Holbrooke thought about it, was that your audience is not just the Taliban. It's actually everybody else around the Taliban. Actually, to him, Pakistan was far more important. So for him, you would have not actually started with the Taliban. You would have started with Pakistan, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Russia, India. You would have sort of a contact group approach. You would have worked this from outside in. You would have got a understanding or a buy-in into a diplomatic effort that would have then maybe constrained Taliban also within Pakistan, would have given the Pakistanis a seat at the table. I mean, to this day, one of the main problems we have with Pakistan is that Pakistanis don't have a seat at the reconciliation table. Even to the extent that we're talking about talking with the Pakistan, our expectation of Pakistan is to deliver everything we want, but they don't have a seat there. They're not at the table. So there are very little incentive, if you would, in the outcome of a diplomatic process that they don't have a say in. So the idea would have been to have a much broader net cast and create a diplomatic strategy that you would work outside in. I guess it's much closer to ways in which we've done the Middle East peace process, where it used to start in Cairo, Amman, and Damascus before you actually really went to the two groups. So it was a recognition that, the Taliban and Karzai in a region, the region is a cause of the war. The region has to buy into your diplomatic strategy, and then you have to work it.
Even with them, they have to believe that you're in it for the long haul. Otherwise, why are they making a deal with you? So let me just kind of pull it back to a much broader question, which is, how... There were two kinds of American interventions in history. There's one like the Philippines, where we went through exactly this exact same set of mistakes, and it was a disaster. We thought we could just go in, they would love us, then they turned out that they hated us, and then we fought them for 4 years. But then we stayed for like another 30 years. And then, there's Japan and Germany after the war. There are these times when America, for whatever reason, makes the long-term commitment. Those things usually end pretty well. And then there are all the times when we don't, when we get in and then we can't wait to get out, and those things generally end badly. So,
I agree with you. First of all, the greatest incentive for Iran and Pakistan in all of this is for the United States to leave, and we gave that as a freebie. So we're leaving anyways. So all they have to wait is for us to go.
Yeah.
If we had a sustainable presence in Afghanistan that you would have even used as a bargaining chip, you might have got something more. But I take all of your points, and also generally that a lot of diplomatic efforts do fail. I mean, it's not a given that diplomacy always succeeds. But look at the way we're leaving. We're leaving without a deal and without a victory and without even having tried this. So even if there was a 10% chance of getting to some kind of a peace settlement, it would have been worth trying it when we had the leverage. So generally... there is no real effort for Afghanistan. The incentive of the Taliban is less, but we're still not really committed. Come 2014, I think generally what we're gunning for is what in Vietnam we refer to as a decent interval between our departure and when things may break apart. Or generally we can look at it in the context of the way we look at the Middle East, that we really don't care what happens. If we can accept Syria, we surely can accept civil war in Afghanistan, and the American public won't care.
Let me shift a little bit before we go to the audience for their questions. In terms of the great game that you describe us as turning our backs on now, you posit the argument that China will end up filling this vacuum and will be dragged back into a new superpower competition with China in the Middle East. I thought that was puzzling when I read it, because my sense from several conversations with the Chinese is that they see this place as just a swamp, that they would much rather that we took care of it, but and they could free ride, but I don't see them as eager to jump in by any means. What I see is, and this is where I'd like you to comment, is what I see is a disintegration into, a series of schisms, one of which you have the patent on,
right,
which is the Sunni Shia schism that is clearly developing in Syria and has the potential to spread across the region from there. And so rather than a new great power competition there, aren't we really going to see just a kind of descent into chaos, which will in the end create, this kind of Al-Qaeda resurgence that we're seeing now in Syria? And that's what we have to be worried about.
Well, my sense is not that the Chinese are gunning to replace us, but there is for the Chinese, the Middle East is a rising strategic concern. For some of it is reasons that are inevitable and unavoidable to them. They need the energy, and the energy comes from Central Asia. It comes from the Persian Gulf, and also the routes to avoid the Straits of Malacca, which, given now the much more emphasis we're putting on South China Sea, and all of it involves the Middle East. So if you look at the patterns of their investment in pipelines, port building, railway building, sovereign fund investment, so it's all directed at building infrastructure to get commodities and minerals and oil and gas out of the Middle East into China, and also to some extent market development. The Chinese have not been as squeamish as we have been in chaotic places. They are heavily invested in the consumer market in Pakistan, for instance, as are all other Asian countries too. So, they calculate the country's a chaos. There's no electricity. There's a lot of terrorism. But there's still a 30 million healthy middle class, market that you can sell plenty of things to. The same then can be said about other places in the Middle East, and they're looking. And the other issue for them is geostrategic, which is the belt around them from Central Asia to Pakistan matters to the stability of Western China. And as more and more of the population and industrial centers are moving west, that's becoming more critical. So what the Chinese, the Pakistanis, and the Indian, Iranians, and the Russians all have in common in terms of strategic view is no United States on your borders. The Chinese also think that, it's much better for the U.S. not to be in Afghanistan, not to be in Pakistan, and not to be in Kyrgyzstan, because ultimately it will infuse China with a separatist democratic bug. Now, it's not that the Chinese are egging to come in, but the point is that I'm making is that it's a mistake to think that the great game with China, which is actually the way the administration is seeing this happening, is going to only happen in the Asia-Pacific. So our conception of Asia is skewed, thinking that it's only there, whereas the Chinese are looking at a bigger playing field, which is Africa, Middle East, and for them, the Middle East has strategic value. For instance, if your objective is global containment of China, does it make sense for you not to have a footprint in Afghanistan and particularly in Pakistan, or to be giving the message to Persian Gulf monarchies that we're out of here, you're on your own? So, where would they look ultimately in terms of investing their future on? So I agree. I don't think the Chinese are eager to get in the middle of the Arab-Israeli issue or into the middle of the sectarian war. And if really the Middle East explodes in a big way, I'm sure you know they will recalibrate the degree of interest they have. But I think the cavalier way we're washing our hands of the Middle East, it's and then saying we're doing so in order to focus on China, it's a faulty assumption that this really is the best way of contending with where the Chinese Chinese at least view of its power play in Asia is going.
Okay, let's go to your questions. If you would please wait for the microphone, identify yourself, and please make sure you ask a question here in the middle.
Thank you very much. Keith Martin, I was a member of Parliament in Canada for six terms, and I'm with the Consortium of Universities for Global Health. Dr. Nasser and Dr. Kagan, thank you for your excellent presentations. If there's a huge opportunity cost for inaction, and DOD recognizes the need to use non-military options to deal with these challenges, whether it's the Middle East, the Sahel, India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, what, in your view, would it take for them to be able to leverage existing limited resources to use a combination of trade, economics, diplomacy, and development to be able to address these challenges? And if state is a handmaiden to DOD, what will it take to change that relationship? Thank you.
Well, I think it's going to be difficult to change that relationship, but it really requires a restructuring the way we look at these conflicts and we look at our engagement in the world. I think, by and large, if you were in the Middle East and South Asia, you would say the principal way the United States is engaging the region is through drones and counterinsurgency. And it's no longer even a military-led foreign policy, but there it's largely led by intelligence agencies. So, Come back to the 50s, exactly. So that requires a much more fundamental shift in looking at all of the sort of elements of American power. On Syria, which is sort of the topic du jour, I think that the argument is put too much debate, even in the media, is an all or nothing. We're either going to have boots on the ground or we're going to do nothing. Over the past 2 years, there are many things the United States could have and should have done. I mean, for instance, support just for the humanitarian crisis in the region, which is one way of that Syria is, beyond just a sectarian issue, is destabilizing the neighborhood. So, the State Department calculates that by end of 2013, there'll be 3 million Syrian refugees, 1 million in Turkey, 1 million in Lebanon, 1 million in Jordan. Can Jordan really survive that? That doesn't require boots on the ground. That actually might require helping Jordan financially, and not from all out of American taxpayer money, but really using America's convening power to get the international community to address at least this aspect of the conflict. Can we do more on diplomacy? Of course. I think we've been hiding behind the Russian veto. There's a lot more the U.S. can do in organizing the opposition, in getting the countries in the region, Europeans, others, organized around what might be a, now that Secretary Kerry is actually approaching this issue of trying to find out what might be the elements of a discussion towards transitional government. I mean, again, if you look at the discussion on Syria, it's too military focused, even in the press. We're not really asking hard questions about what can we do diplomatically, economically, in order to manage this crisis and contain it at least, rather than going back to the scenario that this, either we're going to be back to Iraq or we don't do anything.
Over here. Oh, sorry. Did you want to?
Getting back to your earlier point about the pivot, which I completely agree with you about. My question is, have we actually pivoted? I mean, what do you make of the fact that if you look at John Kerry's travels in the first months of his time in office, he's spent roughly 80% of his time in the Middle East in one way or another.
Well, we definitely chose an anti-pivot Secretary of State who is keenly interested in the Middle East and has a lot of experience there. But I think at a very high level, as I said, you know, beyond the tactical discussions, and I think there's a fundamental assumption this administration has made that the Middle East doesn't matter, and we really should focus on other areas of the world. And I think that it is the Middle East refuses to be ignored, and it's obviously generating more and more crises that is demanding American attention. And I think the administration, at some level, the president, is really resisting revising that assumption. And I think you have this sort of seesaw battle where, in practice, the Middle East is a critical issue. You've had now two, say, foreign leaders visit Washington this week, and Syria's at the top of both of their agendas. And then, you know, G20 and free trade is number two for both the Turkish prime minister and the British prime minister. Syria's top of the both of their agendas. And yet, you know, we still refuse to sort of acknowledge that things that are happening in the Middle East are not just a tragedy. They are a vital national interest for the United States. And I think we're at that stage that, you know, there's need for a corrective in the fundamental direction of our foreign policy to take the Middle East seriously for our own reasons, not out of some altruism to help a country in civil war.
Peter Shutley, a retired State Department at Brookings. And I wonder if, Vali, you could dive a little deeper into the workings of the NSC. And what I'm specifically interested in, at the beginning, when a major review gets started, if a key cabinet secretary, Hillary Clinton, wants an option to be one of the main options, peace negotiations, I don't understand how such an option could not be worked through or considered for a long time, unless the word comes from the very high, from the president, I don't want that option. I can't picture a lower-level staffer, maybe even General Jones or Donilon, saying, no, we're not going to consider a key option favored by one of the key players. So can you explain that a little more, how it is that a key option pursued, favored by a key player, just wasn't considered?
Well, I can only speak for what I saw and also a lot of conversations I had with Holbrooke. The options were ultimately decided by the NSC as to what would be essentially the president would consider. And then all the questions and sub-questions and repeated questions that went on for 2-3 months and the president spent 25-30 hours were around those key options. So diplomacy was very early on shut down as an option. And I think, you know, the way Holbrooke would often say is that it's very clear that the president doesn't like his options. That's why he keeps asking questions, and he doesn't like these options. But the key point was that he wasn't asking for other options. In a way, he was trying to wiggle his way out of a fully resourced counterinsurgency, but in the end, he gave it to them. But he spent 2 months agonizing over whether or not to do it. And then, as a way out, he put a deadline on it. That was his sort of proviso. But at no point did he say, based on at least my understanding from Holbrooke, that I don't like any of these options. And also, it didn't help that he wouldn't meet with Holbrooke. I think the entire time I worked with Holbrooke until he died, he was never given a one-on-one meeting with the president. So, yes, he was at the NSC meeting, but, he was... And exactly the idea was that if you let him in the room with the president, he may convince the president on diplomacy.
It's an interesting parallel with Syria today. The president is unhappy with the options that he's being presented with there. Right. He doesn't see... what he fondly refers to as a theory of the case that would leave the United States in a better position than by not intervening. So they go around trying to find more options.
So many foreign policy problems are like that. I mean, you don't have the wonderful option versus the terrible option. But what the difference is always, Are you to me, it's a matter of, are you generally leaning forward, looking to solve a problem, or are you generally trying to stay back from it? If you're trying to stay back from a problem, the fact that all the options are terrible is a very good way to do it. If you really need to win, I mean, all our options were terrible in 1941. All our options were terrible, but we had no choice, so you fight your way through. And I think on the question of Syria, if the desire was to say, we need to get to this outcome, well, you would try this, you'd try that, you'd keep going. But you can always, and I know that the National Security Advisor does this, he says, well, if we take this step, then step 37 is this. And, you know, so you can always talk yourself out of it if you don't really want to do it.
Which then underscores Valley's broader
right,
point.
Which is that they don't really want to do it.
They want to pivot away from the Middle East, that the president actually sees, when he looks at Syria, he sees Iraq. And he's ending wars in the Middle East, not starting new ones.
That's right. Let's go down the back there to Doyle.
Thank you. Doyle McManus from the Los Angeles Times. Two questions on AFPAC, one backward, one forward. The backward question is on the diplomatic option. Where was Secretary Clinton? Because she ended up, of course, endorsing the military option at the end. Did Holbrooke pitch her on this and get her support or not? And then looking forward, one of many of the admirable qualities of Dick Holbrooke was that he was relentless. He never stopped generating new options for new situations. If Holbrooke were with us today, looking at an Afghanistan going into elections, an American withdrawal, a new government in Pakistan, what options would he be proposing now?
Well, you know, Secretary Clinton was not as enthusiastic off the bat with Holbrooke, but she was open to being persuaded. In fact, she was open in hearing new options and policies the way we were just describing that the NSC wasn't. So Holbrooke argued with her vociferously, showed her evidence, gave her a sense that this is a possibility, and she thought that, you know, we should explore this. She didn't say, you know, I think this is going to work. I even describe in the book that, you know, Holbrooke argued with her very aggressively that we should engage Iran and Afghanistan.
He even followed her into the bathroom.
He even followed the bathroom, account. And I remember she basically said the United States is big enough to walk and chew gum. You can be tough on them on nuclear issue, but you know, if there is a way to get Iran to cooperate on varieties of things or not join hands with the Taliban, or then we ought to pursue it. So you know, she was open to this. So I wouldn't say that she started by gunning for diplomacy. But Holbrooke basically was able to have her ear persuaded that this is an option we should look at. And, you know, varieties of places, you heard her as the person who advocated reconciliation, laid down conditions for the Taliban to come into the talks. And most clearly, on the first Holbrooke Memorial Lecture at Asia Society, she laid these conditions down. And I think she also understood that in the end, she represents the State Department. She represents, obviously, a tough American foreign policy. She believed in, and I think believes in, America's leadership in the world. And also, that end of the day, that she represents diplomats whose main function internationally is to conduct and lead America's foreign policy. So she was much more persuaded that the military has its role, but, you know, in the end, you know, the diplomats have to play their role, and if there is room for diplomacy, we ought to consider it. I think today he still would think that the key to Afghanistan, given where we are, is to get a regional agreement on an end game, at least create certain base understanding between America, Pakistan, India, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and you know, Turkey, and then maybe if you could indirectly through them with Iran, that you can leave Afghanistan. I would say he wouldn't think you could leave Afghanistan in a condition of relationship United States has with Pakistan today. I think if he would have been alive, he would have fought tooth and nail from allowing that relationship to go to dust the way it did. And he would have jumped on the gun that, you know, there's now a new powerful Pakistani civilian government to try to, you know, bring some stability and forward movement in U.S.-Pakistani relations, as if you would, as a sort of a minimum requirement for having stability in Afghanistan. But I think he fundamentally believed Afghanistan will not be stable without Pakistan, and Pakistan, best way of managing Pakistan is to have relations with it. And the more, and because it gives you some levers, and it might give Pakistan certain, at least minimal, incentives. So I think that's where he would have been focused right now.
Iran, we haven't really focused on Iran. You mentioned it there, although I noticed you danced around, and I think Holbrooke would have wanted to bring them in directly,
directly
rather than indirectly.
Yes. Correct.
But why don't you finish up with your views on how the administration is handling Iran, which is also right in the book.
I think the administration was very successful in getting the sanctions to be effective in a very, very important way, in the manner that the Bush administration, which was really the architect of this two-track policy, which is sanctions to get them to table, you know, pressure to get them to table, was not. So, you know, they were able not only to have unilateral financial sanctions, they got the Europeans to sign on to oil embargo, to sign on to financial sanctions. There were even Security Council approved sanctions. So, you know, the sanctions are now really, really effective. I think where they ultimately ended up adopting the Bush administration strategy, I don't think they really came up with a viable, real diplomatic strategy. So if the Iranians come to the table as they did, then, and given that Iranians are very difficult, chances of success are extremely slim. I mean, all of this is given. There's no relationship between two countries for 27 years. There's ample room for distrust. This is not an easy way forward, but that, you know, what would be your strategy if they actually came? What would you negotiate over? What would you test them with? And how can they test you? And I think the calculation is that the domestic price of really testing anything serious with Iran is quite high, because even in the last two rounds, it's clear that the Iranians are really asking specifically what sanctions are attached to what demand. So, you know, for capping at 5%, if we did that, which sanctions would you lift specifically? And then we can haggle over that timeline and whether that's enough, whether it's too much. But there's not really anything on the table other than aircraft parts. So this promise of taking into consideration Iranian good behavior for in the future, but that is even now after Libya, is even less of a value add. And I think the P5+1 approach is really at a dead end. First of all, I don't think you can negotiate by committee. The Iranians fully well know there's one power broker in the room. It's the U.S. The Europeans are not really in a position to break from the U.S. and say, you know, we're going to lift the oil embargo on our own. That's not going to happen. And the Russian and the Chinese are sort of, I think from both the Iranian-American view, are risky partners, because the Iranians are very careful what they say, because, you know, you might also complicate your relationship with them. And we're very careful what we say, because they may go and undermine it behind the scenes, as they've done in the past. So it's a situation that encourages both sides not to be actually audacious in the talks. And so there is a minimalist approach from both sides. It's not a circumstance you can really test ideas and.
But they won't talk to us in any other forum.
No, and that's why this is going to be difficult. It's going to be long run. You know, the idea that, you know, we just will arrive and start something is not really realistic. This is going to be, even getting it on track is difficult. But when it happens, it really requires to have a negotiating position on our part. And Iran, by and large, has now become a domestic American issue more than a foreign policy issue. And I think that really has limited the administration's ability to really maneuver.
Bob?
Well, I think Vali should get the last word.
There it is, Dispensable Nation. Buy a copy. It's a very compelling reading. And I'm sure that you will be stimulated and provoked by it. Vali, congratulations on another great book.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.